Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. When I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I am out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, restaurateurs, big brand startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. Today, we have live in studio partner Mark Maynard Parisi of Blue Smoke Jazz Standard, and he's the founder of the newish Porchlight Bar. And we're going to talk his love affair with the South, landscape architecture, and Manchester, UK in the 80s. But first, we have on the line food TV producer and James Beard Awards judge, Jenna Zimmerman, who's worked on shows for the likes of Food Network and Cooking Channel. And we'll talk the hashtag dream job, how she landed in it, and stories from the front lines of food TV production. Stay to the end, because to wind it down today on Word of Mouth, we've got here with us some bottles that look like some seedy moonshine, but Mark says that they are the world's tastiest lukewarm cocktails. With that, let's go to Jenna on the line.
Hi. Lukewarm cocktails. I'm intrigued.
Wow. So, I know. I wish you could join us here in the studio. They're on purpose lukewarm, though, I hear. I'll drink an extra.
It sounds good as the weather cools down here in New York.
I'll drink an extra one for you.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
You've got one of those hashtag dream jobs, Jenna. And how did you even, land in it?
Well, people ask me that a lot, particularly kids in school. And I had a bit of a roundabout journey to where I am. I loved food growing up, even though my mom did not cook. And I think that's why I fell in love with it, because I was sort of left to fend for myself. And then I found Food Network, and that sort of became my culinary family. And I just watched all day, every day. I cut classes to watch it. And one day on a whim, I thought I would take an internship with one of the production companies, because they were producing not far from where I was living in Northern California. And I took it, and it was totally unglamorous. I was washing dishes. I washed a car at one point. But I loved it. I loved being on set. I loved the energy. I loved being around the food all the time. And they hired me again, and then they referred me to the Food Network in New York. And I flew out for an interview, convincing them that I was actually moving to New York. And they hired me freelance, and that turned into a full-time job, and I really did move to New York.
You're like, I plan on being there next week. No big deal. You're like, I'm planning on going there anyway. Like, I'm just going to pop in, okay? Cool.
I said, I live in New York.
Where's your apartment? You know, they're like, where'd you get an apartment?
I'm subletting right now. I'm sort of in transition.
And your mom comes from the world of TV, so she's probably whoa.
Yeah, so it is most surprising to me, I think, of anyone, that I'm in television. My mom was a broadcast anchor in San Francisco, and everybody would ask me, am I going to follow in my mother's footsteps? And I, as any, rebellious child would shirk and cringe and say, no, I'm going to, find my own thing. And so then I found food, and then food took me into television, and here I am. I think despite our best efforts, we become our parents in so many ways.
She was a token Asian broadcaster broadcast journalist.
Yes.
I have to.
Yes.
I have to.
Yes.
Say
it's from South Park. I always laugh.
So you've worked with the likes of Michael Chiarello, Tyler Florence, Guy Fieri, Rachel Ray, Scott Conant, Alton Brown, Alex Ronicelli, like everybody. I mean, you're like a chef whisperer. And how do you get these stars, these personalities comfortable and happy and help them to be their best?
Well, everybody is different, and you can figure out their vibe pretty quickly when you spend some intimate time with them. For example, Guy likes to just go right in the beginning of the day, and so does Rachel. Melissa D'Arabian likes to take her time. She gets there like 2 hours early and wants, peaceful morning. So you sort of pick up on those cues, and then you have to respond to them. And people like Guy and Rachel, with so many things going on, I've learned I just can't be afraid to bring things up. They're reading the cue sheet for their cookware line, but if I know that their pork roast is taking too long, then I will bring it up with them and I'll troubleshoot it in the middle. And that was a huge learning lesson for me. Is to just be direct. Most of these people, in kitchens are not, beating around the bush when, they're trying to get a meal out. So being direct is best, and then getting to the heart of their recipes both warms them up and gets them excited to share the recipe with the audience. And also, as a double bonus, the audience really responds to these stories, and they love getting this intimate look inside the chef's life.
When you're spending this time with these folks, like right before they go on camera or on air, it's like you're kind of there when they're the most vulnerable, when they're at their best and at their like absolute worst, right? Like, do you? Are they?
How do you mean?
Was there ever like a moment where you had like a moment with somebody where you're the one who's empowering them to do what they need to do?
Definitely. When I started, I was working on the team at Food Network that took all of the chefs or cooks who won Next Food Network Star, and we developed their shows for them. And so those people in particular, were very vulnerable and scared and nervous, and they would mess up a lot and take it out on themselves and be critical, and then their performance suffers. When we do this fourth, sixth, tenth take. And so those are the times where you just need to go down, come out of the control room, come on set, and just sit with them and get back to where they're coming from and why they're here, and, get them back in that headspace of, I'm here to share this recipe that means so much to me. And unless I need to be perfect, I'm on TV, to get them in the space of, I'm just here in my kitchen sharing this recipe with my good friends.
So you have your eye on like kind of everybody on the team, the sound guy, the food stylist, you're making sure that the recipes work, you're like doing everything. Does that make cooking at home way easy for you?
So much easier. So much easier. I've staged in a couple of restaurants, and that totally revolutionized the way that I cook, just getting all the mise en place ready and keeping the station clean and everything. But juggling all of this crew on set really has made me, Thanksgiving is coming up, and that is, it's been so helpful because I can now delegate tasks. I'm the only one in my family who cooks. I mean, I asked my sister to grab me the food processor, and she brought me a stand mixer. Like, nobody knows anything about cooking, but it has made me a better communicator in the kitchen. It has made me a better delegator. It has made me more flexible. Definitely just focusing more on the big picture and less on the, there's too much parsley in the stuffing, but getting it off the table is the end game. So,
a boss.
In the same way that getting the same way that getting a TV show on air is the end game.
What's your most ridiculous or awesome day on the job?
Well, I got to meet Matthew McConaughey what? And play the bongos with him.
Wait, how did that happen? Awesome. Hold on. How did that happen?
I forget exactly how he met. I think maybe he met Guy on Diners, Drive-ins, and Dives. He happened to be in a restaurant or around a restaurant or tweeted at Guy to put his favorite restaurant on Triple D, but they met, they became friends. Guy said, hey, you know, I want you to be on my cooking show. And Matthew said, cool. So he came down. He was, and I'll say this, you know, I don't want to drop names, but I'll say, you know, Brooke Shields also came on. And these two people blew my mind. I was so nervous to work with them. But they were the most kind, professional, buttoned up people I've ever worked with. And I think it goes to show just the professionalism of seasoned, you know, television vets.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I think also they have a good soul.
Okay, so non-food, but Matthew McConaughey is delicious like food.
Yeah, and he was game for anything, and he shared a recipe. We did an Oysters Rockefeller that he liked, and
so he
really liked Ting, that
so Matthew McConaughey cooks
drink from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And so he made his own cocktail out of that. And
what?
He was a lot of fun. You know, he likes food, you know, even though he's not, you know, in the industry per se, he likes food and entertains. And it was fun to see that side of, you know, somebody that we all feel like we know.
So you know how to play the bongos? Like, that's something that you have these,
oh,
like...
I have no idea how to play the bongos. But he didn't really care, you know, it was all about just sort of grooving and vibing, and I was laughing the entire time, and he was not. He was really into it. His eyes were closed, and he was really feeling it. But, yeah, I just sort of went for it.
Oh, my gosh. So, what... There's all this web video and mobile video, and you're bringing all that big TV experience, and food is now like for everybody, right? Everyone's a foodie.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like the F word, but everyone's a foodie. So what's next in food media that you're stoked for?
Well, because everybody is a foodie and everybody's so interested in what's going on in the food world, and chefs are celebrities now, I think I've been seeing them use that celebrity as a platform to share what their concerns are for the world, which are becoming, you know, many. And, you know, for example, Dan Barber did an event where he took food waste or scraps that would ordinarily be thrown away in a restaurant and created a whole evening, and then it turned into multiple evenings to have guest chefs come and cook with these food, quote-unquote, scraps and make a sit-down dinner out of them. And I think that that was really great to challenge people to think differently about the way they order, you know, as guests, and also utilize food in the restaurants as chefs. And so I think I'm excited to see chefs use their voices that are now so loud in so many homes to do good, to spread messages that need to be heard about, you know, our food system, about the, you know, global economy, about sustainability.
I'm excited for the scaling of storytelling, because with traditional TV, you have all this, you have to have a huge team and the location and all the equipment, and to be able to just pull out like my iPhone and do something, it's like, yeah, you know, that feels really good.
Completely. You know, I think TV has been so wonderful and so attractive to people because it's multi-sensory. You know, I'm still working on the smell-o-vision. That's sort of a goal of mine in this lifetime. But, yeah, now everybody in their pockets has this powerful device to share experiences, you know, beyond just a photograph or a caption, and it's going to be transporting for people. You know, people in Vietnam are going to be able to see what we're eating here in New York and vice versa. And it's democratized and unedited through a lens of a network or, you know, somebody with a board of advisors. You know, you or I can do it and just share what we really think right now or what we're really experiencing right now.
Thank you so
much. I think that's awesome.
Thank you so much, Jenna.
Thank you for having me on.
For coming on.
I'll see you
in,
I don't know, half an hour for room temperature cocktail.
Yay! All right. Cool. We've got an extra here for you.
Awesome. I'll see you soon.
That was just Jenna Zimmerman, TV producer, James Beard Media Awards judge. And you're listening to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're at Heritage_radio. And I'm at Leitihsu, L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U, #WOMSHOW, short for Word of Mouth. Talk to us. You can also hit subscribe and listen to the show anytime, anywhere through iTunes or Stitcher. And after this quick commercial break, we'll have Mark Maynard Parisi, the dude behind Blue Smoke and Porchlight Bar. Stay tuned.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hello, I'm Alice Marcus Creek.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we're the ladies of We Dig Plants. And today we're asking you to dig deep into your pockets and help us grow this radio station and our podcast and everything that you know and love about us.
How do you do it? You go to the heritageradionetwork.org website. You will see a beating heart. It's on every page. And you can give a dollar, you can give $5, you can give whatever.
$500.
$500, $5,000. Just click on the heart, donate, and help support the radio that you love.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leitihsu on Heritage Radio Network. We have up live in studio, people we like. Mark Maynard Parisi, partner in Porchlight, also the founder. The brandish, newish bar with the Union Square Hospitality Group. And he is also involved in Blue Smoke. He absolutely loves the American South. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, lady. It's great to be here.
So, okay, what's new at Porchlight? You know, you guys are what, like a year, half a year?
We opened in March.
Okay.
So we're less than a year old. It's our first holiday season. It's so far so good. It's been a great, amazing 9 months.
There's a new live music series.
Wow, you cut right to the chase. Yeah,
you
know, we were talking about music and
I've stalked you.
Yeah. After I spent 13 years at Jazz Standard, which is under Blue Smoke, I when I opened Porchlight, I knew I always wanted to have live music as part of Porchlight. So we have something called Live from the Porch, which is every Monday night. We do live music, and so far we've had blues and bluegrass and some jazz. Definitely want to get some country and some reggae in there.
Yay! Oh my gosh, is there going to be dancing?
You know, technically we're not supposed to have dancing in New York City, but we won't judge.
Amazing.
So yeah, we're really looking forward to that. It's been great. We've done four weeks so far, and it's been really, really fun.
Yeah, the whole like the cabaret like license thing is like this really weird, creepy, like old school fucked up.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, right up there with prohibition, I guess.
Yeah, so, like you're not allowed to dance in some venues in New York, even though dancing is what life is all about.
That's dancing and drinking, I would say.
Yeah.
So those are, you know, dancing, drinking, listening to music.
I meet all of my business partners on the dance floor.
It's
for real.
That's scary.
Yeah.
So we would have never met if I were on the dance floor. You would have run the other way.
I'm really excited about this live music series. You guys are in a kind of a funky neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those neighborhoods that has been, I think, underserved for so long. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who've worked over there for many years, and they've always had to walk a long way to get a good drink. It's been pretty amazing what the neighborhood has, how the neighborhood has supported us. We've been really, really psyched, and it's amazing. So, you know, sort of from 5 o'clock to 9 o'clock,
It's packed.
It's packed from happy hour, and then it slows down a little bit, and then all of the sort of industry folks start showing up around 9:30, 10 o'clock as they get off their shifts, and the bartenders and the servers and the cooks. So it's busy again starting around 10, 10:30, which is pretty cool.
When I was last there, I totally met the randomest, like, guy. He works like around the corner at there's like a dealership of really high-end cars.
Yeah, maybe, right.
Like, $200,000 cars.
He's a good guy to know.
Yeah. Okay, so he was like, I fix these like really high-end cars, and I am kind of a baller at that job. Yeah. And I was sort of like just chilling. I don't know. I was chilling at the bar by myself, as I do. I was just like, this is so random. And he was like the last guy that, I mean, I guess you would you know what I mean? Like he's just the bar. That bar is so weirdly democratic, and the drinks are so funky. And
it's been pretty cool because, you know, when you think about it, we in the bar industry and the restaurant industry, you know, we use the word craft all the time, you know, craft cocktails, craft this, craft that. And, I mean, think about what this guy does. Like, he works on Maseratis and Lamborghinis. So he's got to be a craftsman. He's not just some dude who has no idea what he's doing. So he understands a well-crafted cocktail as much as the next guy. And I bet he doesn't drink Bud Light. Ooh, I shouldn't say that. Sorry. I bet he doesn't drink light beer.
You know exactly who I'm talking about, right?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a group. There's a whole group from over there, which is pretty cool.
It's like, I think I really nerded out about it because it was like an auto mechanic, which is like a certain stereotype, but he was like the creme de la creme of auto mechanics.
Right. He probably has his hands insured.
Insured,
you know, like pianists, concert pianists do. I don't know.
Totally.
I just made that up, by the way.
And your mother, is an interesting cat.
Yeah, she is.
She totally like did what all moms should do. Yay! Which is like after raising you.
Yeah,
guys,
she raised
sort of
five
halfway.
Kids and then went to culinary school.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Where does she cook?
So, well, now she doesn't cook. She's retired. Yeah. But she went to the Johnson & Wales weekend program for 2 years. So it was pretty amazing that for 2 years, my father and five boys somehow managed to not kill one
another.
That is
scary.
Yeah, it's a pretty, pretty amazing thing. But the weirdest, so yeah, I think when she turned 40 that she went to culinary school, which is pretty bold. And
never too late, guys.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it, really awesome. And then it was amazing about it is we got to try everything she did, and there were a lot of failures, you know, like, so when, you know, she was working on a certain thing, you know, like we went through the mother sauces, you know, and then, you know, we went through pasta making and, you know, rice dishes, and it was, you know, how to braise, you know, so it was like, we would go like 3 weeks at a time eating only, you know, braised things or only fried things. It was pretty cool.
I had the same experience. I totally was like dating this guy when I was in the short course of the FCI culinary school, like La Technique, you know, back when that existed. And I would totally bring home like a quart container of lobster stock and like be like, hey,
risotto.
Yeah. You know, right? And it's just like, we would stand there. Like I would come home like at 11 PM and we would stand at the kitchen counter and like, and I wanted him to eat it because, you know, it's all this leftovers and it's really good, but you're like already all like full.
Yeah, you smell like lobster
grimy.
Sock.
Yeah,
the last thing you want. Yeah.
Totally delicious. Yeah. So you and your brothers got into a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny when your mother's away in your teens, you do things like throw rocks and stuff like that.
So, boys are so dumb.
Yeah, we kind of are. You know, like we didn't necessarily know our limits. You know, so we were always doing. We also lived in a rural place, so you know there wasn't. It was a sort of thing where, you know, like throwing rocks at trains was something we did. And that's all cool until the engineer of the train decides to come out and start chasing you. You know, like stuff like that. You know, one of my brothers was we had an apple tree in the backyard and he famously jumped from the top of it. And my mother didn't believe that he had broken his leg. So she waited. She waited 2 days until he really wouldn't stop whining to finally bring him to the hospital.
Your mom was so amazing.
Yeah, she was kind of like, "This serves you right," you know. So yeah, it probably made it worse, but he's still alive. He's still doing okay. Yeah, he turned out okay.
So one time you guys had another train mishap.
Like... Yeah. We like to wrestle in groups. You know, again, when you get boys together. You know, we have no editor. So one of my brothers and I started wrestling at the top of a train embankment. And it was the middle of the winter. So it was very snowy and icy. And we started pushing one another. And, you know, as so happens, we each took the other guy down this train embankment and ended up on the train tracks. And I think I still have the scar above my left eye. And my brother had a few bruises as well. And it was one of those things where, you know, it is that question of like, do you go home and tell your parents what just happened? Do you make up a lie or do you hope they don't notice the gash in your forehead? You know, I can't remember what we decided, but I'm sure we got grounded and, you know, we were always doing something pretty stupid. So
I think the reason why we get along so well is because we're like kind of the same bear. We're kind of like versatile and weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's when you have weird, I am definitely weird.
Because like, you're known within the company to be like the straight talker.
Yeah, you know, which is weird because to me it's kind of like, well, just say what's on your mind, which pretty much most of my life has gotten me into trouble. I mean, I was in detention in middle school, you know, for telling the teacher that he mispronounced something. And, you know, I think I probably have scar tissue on one side of my face for where my parents would, you know, sort of smack me for being a wise guy. But when you're number 4 out of 5 kids... You know, you're fighting for attention. So, you know, it was something that I tended to do a lot, was fight for attention. What that helped is that those survival skills. You know, it helped with survival skills. So I knew how to, you know, I had a big family, so I knew how to work with different types of people. You know, certain people are more analytical, so I learned how to slow down. Certain people are more energetic, and I learned how to speed up. So that was pretty cool.
What's your like? What was your high school stereotype? Like, who were you,
you know,
in high school?
I was pretty much perfect, so I don't know. If I,
prom king?
Yeah, no. I had a face for radio. That's why it's great on this show. You know, I was the guy who was friends with everyone, which was pretty cool because, you know, I was friends with enough of the jocks that I was safe. You know, I was friends. I was the dumbest kid in all the smart classes. So I did really well, but I always struggled. But I had enough smart friends who could kind of help me along. I was the president of the ski club, which was
that's
really
kinda cool.
It
like
was
cool.
A very cool club to be.
Okay.
Except there was in my junior year, there were some illicit drugs found, and they shipped us all home. I was not part of it, I'm happy to say. But so for my senior year, which should have been my crowning year, the ski club was not in existence anymore.
Oh, my gosh.
So that kind of was, you know, the parents weren't too happy about, you know, the fact that 5 kids got suspended for illegal drug activity on a ski trip up
in
Vermont.
But you were one of the 5? Or?
I was not. Okay. But I was the president of the club, so they kind of shut it down.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was
lessons learned.
Bum rap. No more free ski tickets for me. But I did eventually end up as a ski bum a couple of years after graduation, so I sort of got my, I got it back. So,
and you were also in drama.
Yeah, I did all the plays and all the musicals and it was pretty goofy. You know, we did all the, you know, all the classics that were running around in the 80s.
Are you kind of like a
you know, performer type?
Some would say, yeah. I mean, I think that's what's pretty cool about being leading a group of people now is that I get to, you know, stand in front of people a lot and talk, you know? So which is pretty cool. So yeah, I guess I have a big ego. Yeah, definitely.
How did you meet your wife?
How did I meet? Well, this is actually pretty cool. I had moved to New York from Vermont from that ski bum job. It was actually 2 years after graduation, and I still hadn't had what anyone would call a real job. And I moved to New York, and my college roommate is the one who hired me. He was working for a firm, a landscape architecture firm, because that's what I did before restaurants and bars.
Oh my God, wait a minute. Okay, so
yeah, that, how did I slip that one in there?
Yeah, yeah. Landscape architecture, like, wow. So
my dream was to design parks.
Do you still keep up with landscape architecture?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, I keep up with friends who do landscape architecture.
Okay, but, so what's like, what's the epitome of landscape architecture these days? Like, who are the people we should be following and paying attention to?
So I have to plead total ignorance because
okay, wow.
I don't really keep up
You've
with
left
it like
it.
That.
Okay.
I've left it. Yeah. But
you totally studied it.
I mean,
it?
I think the High Line, which is really an amazing project, is the sort of thing which Porchlight is right off of in West Chelsea. That is pretty much the sort of project that a landscape architect would run. And that I walk on the High Line as much as humanly possible because it brings me so much joy to think like that's like a landscape architect did this, you know, along with a whole lot of other people. But that's the sort of dream that I would have loved to have done. And actually a friend of mine, he runs all of the capital projects for Central Park right now. And he's been doing that for years. And so that's really cool to think that, you know, he's helping to design and create history and sort of recreate history. At one of the most popular places on earth.
So when you had two landscape architecture jobs because in New York we're all hustling and
right you got
no company
gotta hustle. Like everyone who works with us right now. I mean, I think most of us have. I mean, most of the servers and bartenders and hosts, yeah,
have multiple passions and
yeah.
No one company sometimes can fully afford us if we're good.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's a sort of thing where when I moved to New York, you know, I was working, I think, probably 15, 20 hours at two different places. And it was okay, you know, it was okay. But
you had to diversify.
I had to diversify, you know, and also I have a very short attention span. So it was really cool to I actually just applied for a job at this place called Union Square Cafe, which in, you know, 1992, you know, you would just say Union Square Cafe. You wouldn't say, you know, Union Square Cafe and then the Angels would sing. Right, exactly. You know, so it was a really amazing neighborhood restaurant that was getting well known.
How many years old was the restaurant?
7 years.
Oh, okay.
7 years. So it was pretty well, you know, it was getting to be well known. Danny Meyer was.
But imagine that back then it took 7 years for it to.
Yeah.
These days, like this typical cycle for restaurants is first year, hot, hot, hot.
Right.
Second year, everyone forgets about them. Third year, the restaurant has got to find other
it's
ways.
Closed, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God there was no internet back there, you know, back then. So, you know, I applied and I really fell in love with this place and I was like, wow, this is so cool. And a lot kind of happened in sort of the first 18 months. I was a host there. I was still working two jobs. I met this girl and she was introduced to me by, one of my college roommates. A lot happened. And then ultimately, I had to do what a lot of us in our industry do is have the talk with your parents.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Which is, I know I studied X, but I actually kind of think I want to do this restaurant thing. And, you know, and a lot of times that happens while you're still paying off your college debt. So that's kind of what happened to me. And my parents were like, okay, well, what kind of restaurant is it? And I explained and they looked it up and they were like, okay, you're good. You know?
Oh, so, really? Okay. So, it already had that reputation.
And yeah. Yeah, that was great.
And I find that the, you know, the Union Square Hospitality Group is one of, you know, many restaurant organizations now that have this, like, extra level of professionalism that allows, like, weird people like you.
Hey.
And me-ish. Not, you know, I'm not in restaurants. Well, I kind of am. But, like, you know, people like you too.
Right.
Smart people who
right.
are overachievers.
Yeah. Well, and also back then, you know, it's the sort of thing where, you know, most of us didn't have any sort of degree from Cornell Hospitality Group, Hospitality School.
Yeah, because you went to Cornell for landscape architecture, which is hilarious.
Which is hilarious. But my brother was a hotelier. My older brother was a hotelier at Cornell. And I actually,
oh, he was?
Yeah, so I kind of, and I was actually a bellman at the hotel school, at the hotel there. So I'd always worked in restaurant jobs. One of my favorite jobs early on was at a place called College Town Bagels in Ithaca. And I didn't know how much I was learning as a kid with long hair and a bandana. You know, like, they taught me so much about how to run a business, even though I was just some kid, you know, like we were all kids, just college kids working, you know, 10, 15 hours a week. And so, you know, we could kind of translate a lot of that, those skills into a fine dining restaurant, you know, which was cool. And the thing about Danny and the management team at the time was, they really looked for people who were curious and hardworking. And I think the curiosity was something that was very cool.
So that
kept me going.
In that moment that you were like, okay, landscape architecture / my third job, restaurants, like what was like the night or the day or the what was the moment where you're like, oh gosh, I have to, I don't know.
Well, there was a positive one and a negative one. There are actually a couple of different things, and that's so much in life. One of the things, after I graduated college, I traveled around the world for about a year and a half.
Where did you go?
Oh, I went a lot to Europe, but New Zealand and Australia and Hawaii and Singapore, but mostly in Europe. But I stopped for about 6 months in Australia.
How many countries in total?
I don't know.
Ish.
12?
Gosh, okay.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool. And I broke my foot in Greece playing frisbee, you know, stuff like that.
Really,
you know,
cool.
So I had to stay in Santorini for 3 weeks, you know, not so bad. And so I just lost my train of thought. How about that?
Australia.
Yeah, so
You probably... You were trying to go back to Australia.
I was trying to go back to Australia, right? Mm-hmm. So I worked for this firm, and they said, you know, you should really come back. It would be awesome. And this, it was such a cool place because it was a half a block from the beach in Perth, Western Australia. So it was pretty much perfect.
And I love Australia.
Yeah, and they were sponsoring me. They were paying to have me go. You know, they're paying for all the paperwork and stuff like that. And at the same time, I was working at Union Square Cafe. I had these two landscape architecture jobs. I had just met this girl, and I actually got denied residency in Australia. They said, we need teachers. We don't need landscape architects. And so get off. And so that was kind of this moment. And that was probably in 1994 where I said, all right, I got to figure out what's going on here. And I decided to... lose the landscape architecture jobs. I thought it was a sign. Proposed to my wife, to my girlfriend.
Okay. But before you proposed to her, though,
what did I do first?
Yeah, like, how did you even, like...
Well, this is where it's really handy to work in a restaurant where you have awesome colleagues. So, I used to work the lunch shift. And there was this the sous chef at the time is a lovely man named Larry Finn. Larry, if you're out there, thank you. I went to him and I said, hey, I really want to impress this girl. Like, could we, you know, could you hook me up with a menu? And so we talked about it, and he dictated to me how to make this awesome meal. And it was, and you know, he asked me all these questions like any good chef would, or you know, or any good consultant would. And he said, you know, what is she like, you know, what's your time frame, what are you, you know. And so I made sauteed shrimp with spinach, some sort of rice thing, and I had to make a beurre blanc. And then I had to pair. And then I also spoke to my boss at the time, Paul, and I asked him which wine to pair with it.
Paul, what's last name?
Paul Bowles-Bevan.
Okay.
So I paired a Chablis with it, which was great.
Wow, yeah.
So it was a it was this really cool thing. So, and also it's like one of these weird New York stories where, you know, so many of us live with like 12 roommates. Well, I somehow landed on Go because a friend's uncle, spent 6 months out of the year in Sarasota, Florida. And she said, you know, my uncle's looking for someone to house sit. Would you mind, you know, would you be interested in house sitting? And I was like, yeah, sure. What does the apartment look like? You know, meanwhile, I was on 71st and Central Park West. So pretty good, impressive kind of apartment to have as a 25-year-old who just moved to New York.
You know,
doesn't really happen.
Mark!
You know, whose parents aren't wealthy or whatever. You know, so I had this, and I had a little garden in the back. It was a ground floor thing. So that was a pretty cool thing. So I made this wonderful this wonderful dinner in this beautiful apartment.
And what number of date was this?
I don't. It wasn't in the beginning because okay. You know. But I'd say you know after maybe 20 or 30 dates.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean for that level of commitment.
Damn.
There, you know, I mean I went.
You really?
You know,
like...
we had gone to a lot of crappy bars in the East Village before that because she lived in the East Village.
Okay, so note to women out there. Be cool with the crappy bars 30 times.
Oh, come on. We were both poor New Yorkers, you know. So
as a skeptical, you know, modern day woman, like if a guy were house sitting, like you also, it begs the question like, okay, so like, who are you really?
Right,
yeah.
Right,
exactly. Why are you really house sitting?
Exactly.
Like,
luckily I had a pretty good, she had vetted me because her sister was dating my best friend. So she had all the dirt on me long before she even met me.
Amazing.
So that was good.
Gosh.
So she knew my faults and strengths before she even laid eyes on me. So that's good.
You're like, really, I've been a good boy, Santa.
Yeah, I didn't even have a social media footprint at that time, you know, so that was good.
Incredible. Yeah. Speaking of, you can stay in touch with Mark on at M Maynard P.
That sounds right.
Right? Okay, I got it right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, you in your travels somehow landed at some point in Manchester, UK,
yeah.
But you had like some really good advice going into it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I was at Cornell, I always wanted to do something different. Like I was always that kid who was always trying to, you know, let's try something different for a night. Well, one thing that was different I wanted to try is I never lived in another country, and I didn't want to do like a semester abroad. I wanted to like actually live in another country, and so there was this grant that I applied for. Through Cornell, and I happened to win it, which was pretty cool. And it was to study urban design in other countries. And I had to write a thesis for it, and it was this really cool thing. And so I wanted to do work in Germany and the UK. And so I actually met with a sort of mentor of my brother, who was a man named Mr. Oberoi, who owned a bunch of hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite famous at the time, and he's since passed away. And I said, you know, Mr. Oberoi, I'm really thinking of getting a job in London. This was in London. I met with him in London. And he said, you know, Mark, London's always going to be here. Go somewhere different. You know, try somewhere different. And so I applied for jobs in London, but in Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Manchester. And I'd never even really heard of Manchester other than knowing that the Smiths, that Morrissey was from Manchester. And I was into the whole, you know, modern music scene at the time. So mm-hmm. when I got this job, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. So, you know, it was right down the street from a club. And Manchester, it's very interesting because now I'm in West Chelsea, Manhattan, and it has a lot of that same feeling, you know, this gritty kind of neighborhood. And now Manchester's a fancy city, which is pretty amazing. But at the time, it was very much an industrial city. It was really built in the 1800s, and it felt like old New York in a lot of ways. And I loved it, and it was great. And the other good thing about being in a place like Manchester is I was the only American that anyone knew. So they had the only preconceived notions they had is what they read on the, you know, read in the paper or saw on the news. but they had never met an American. I mean, so many of these people had never met an American. So I was so fortunate that I got invited to dinner, parties. Like it was great to be, to be a novelty.
To be a black sheep, Baba.
Exactly. It was great. It was very cool. So yeah, it was fun.
So three last questions before we have just a couple minutes for our little in-studio wind it down.
Oh yeah.
Tasting. So rapid fire. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. When you interview people, since you you do all that, what are you trying to find out and how do you find that out?
I want to find out, do they have a sense of humor? Okay. I ask everyone, what's so great about you and what do you suck at?
Okay. What's so great about you and what do you suck at? Okay, cool.
And if they're like, oh, what's so great about me? I'm really organized. That kind of means they don't have a sense of humor.
And you're like, eh, okay.
But if they say, oh, what? Where do I start? You know, it's kind of
then they're
kind of
like
fun
thing. And yeah, stuff. Right. And you want to have that beer with them.
Right.
Your love for the South. Why is the South awesome? One sentence.
The South is awesome because there's so much going on there. It's really diverse in what you can get there. And it's more than most of us Northerners think it is.
Incredible. And finally, dream job if you weren't a oddball restaurateur.
Professor.
Wow. In what subject?
Hotel and restaurant administration.
Oh,
I just made
that
up. I don't know.
Really? You want to teach?
I want to teach. I love teaching.
Cool.
Yeah.
You got the glasses for it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Finally, we're going to do a little wine it down.
Oh, yeah.
With not wine, but this bottle of something that's lukewarm, but on purpose.
Right. We call it room temperature. We don't call it tepid or lukewarm.
Or swamp water.
Or
okay,
swamp
cool.
water. So this is... So, I have the pleasure of working with two guys who are kind of nutty. Actually, a lot of them are. But Nick Bennett, who's our head bartender, and Mike Shane, who's our GM. And we had a really cold day a few weeks ago, and it was during the whole warm thing. But it was this nice cold day, and Nick said, you know, I really want to do a room temperature cocktail. And I was like, well, what's room temperature? Like, I've heard of a hot cocktail and a cold. He's like, I don't want ice to touch it. And I said, all right, dude, whatever, you know, figure it out. And so we tasted a few cocktails. And this one is made with Geneva and Becherovka and Amaretto. And in addition to some walnut liqueur that we make. Mm. And when I tasted it, the only thing I could think of was sitting by the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we called it the Fireside Chat. Which is quite delicious and
nutty, some Russianish stuff in it.
Yeah, the Becherovka is a Czech bitter liqueur.
Yes, it comes in like a green bottle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it kind of tastes like Christmas, you know. So when I first smelled it, I was like, I've smelled that before. And someone was like, yeah, have you ever been to a candle store? You know, but.
In a good way, though.
In a good way. No, but like when you mix it with all the other stuff, you know, the floral stuff and the Geneva, and it's just so yummy. And when you drink it, I can see you're like it's like it makes you relax.
Yeah. Oh,
and you
know,
that's what we want to do. You know, that's what we want to do at Portslade. You know, because you never know what happens after a few of these. We serve it in a flask. We don't serve it. We serve it in a snifter. You know, here we're drinking in a flask because I had to carry it on the L train.
But I thought
snifters don't work on the L train. So
thank you so much, Mark.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
That was Mark Maynard Parisi. Now, actually, you'll see him all the time at Portslade. And, you know, Union Square Cafe and Blue Smoke and the Jazz Standard. And at the top of the show, we had independent food TV producer Jenna Zimmerman. She's the Chef Whisperer. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks to our excellent sound engineer, Liz Smith, with us in the studio today. I'm your host, Leyte. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.